Welcome to Funding and Disrupting, the most in-depth business podcast for companies looking to raise money and the investors who fund them. Every episode, we interview a funded founder, plus the investor who funded them, to get the real story of how it all came together. If you're searching for funding for a disruptive technology or business, or you're searching for the best companies to invest in, then you've come to the right place. This episode of Funding and Disrupting is brought to you by Aura Collective, a leading tech PR and marketing firm. Let's get funding and disrupting.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Keith Herman, and welcome to Funding and Disrupting. Today's interview is with Nicholas Cox, the founder and managing partner of Velocity Ventures. Velocity is a micro fund based in Singapore that is helping startups in the travel and hospitality industry. Nicholas has a unique story that led him to venture capital world, and we're going to hear all about it in today's interview. We also have with us Hans Paul from Agens, a unique and disruptive company. And Hans is going to share with us what that is all about. And we're going to move right on to the interview. How are you today, gentlemen?
Very good. Thank you for having us here, Keith.
Sure. It's great to have you on, and we want to hear about your unique funding and disrupting story. So before we get into all of that, I'd like to just talk with Nicholas just briefly here, because he has a very unique background. In fact, it resonates with me because Nicholas started his career at Arthur Andersen, which specializes in debt workouts, turnarounds, liquidations, and receiverships. And around the same time, I started my career handling all the judgment debtor cases for the famous automaker, John DeLorean. So right around the same time. So it resonates with me. And I want to hear, what motivated you to start in that place in that time of your life?
Oh, that's a great question, Keith. So I was recruited on campus at the Australian National University by a partner of Arthur Andersen, John Murphy, who came to the campus. And he was looking for guys who were graduating from the economics and accounting and commerce faculty. And we all lined up and we went to interviews with all what was then the Big Eight. And that was the place you went when you had a commerce degree in an Aussie uni. You went into the Big Eight and you either did auditing, you did tax, or you wanted to do workouts and insolvency. And I figured that was a more interesting thing than being an auditor or a tax accountant. So I signed up for the latter without really knowing a lot about it. And I'm very happy I did. I had 4 awesome years working with John and the team at Arthur Andersen, and they were great times.
Well, interesting, because then after that portion in your life, you transitioned and decided to become an entrepreneur and open your own business. And similarly, I did the same in a similar field, unrelated to the debt and workouts and all that. So what happened that you decided to leave a desk job and move on to something entrepreneurial?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd been working for Arthur Andersen for 4 years, and we'd done, you know, a lot of fun things. We'd done receiverships, we'd done liquidations, we'd done workouts, but I wanted to do something of my own. And my dad had been an entrepreneur, and I kind of had a bit of a travel bug, so I headed off to Indonesia from Sydney where I was working, and I got to Indonesia pretty much as a backpacker. And started looking around, and I rang my dad one day, reverse charges, which is what you did in those days when you didn't have any money and you wanted to call your parents. And I rang my dad and said, hey, there's a huge opportunity to do a concrete business, which was the business that my father was in Australia, to do a concrete business in Indonesia. And he had just retired, and I managed to convince him to part with a bit of his retirement kitty, and I stayed there. I never came back, and that was the beginning of my entrepreneurial career. I started a concrete business in Indonesia called ReadyMix.
Yes, quite a career. You've been there. You were there for quite a long time. It's interesting that, again, you decided to transition into something else. And we're going to get into that in a minute. But I want to bring Hans in here and talk with him. He also has an interesting path, and I want to touch upon that. So, Hans, why don't you tell us briefly about how you started prior to leading up to Agent?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a Hong Kong national, and I moved to the U.S. when I was about 16, 17. Yeah, so went to school in Berkeley, and after that, I actually, right after I finished school, I pretty much planned to stay in the U.S., right? And I think that was kind of like the crossroad when you are hitting 30, right? Then you felt like, hey, I actually enjoy, you know, what I did in the U.S., making good money, having a good life. And then that was the time that, you know, there's a big China dream, right? That's that big dream in, you know, going back to Asia, right? So, I mean, it took me a while to think about, hey, should I stay in the U.S. or move back to Asia? Then in the end, I mean, for family, I decided to move back to Hong Kong. When I moved back to Hong Kong, my ex-coworker in the U.S., Peter, kind of, you know, one day just asked me out for coffee and, you know, say, hey, you know, we could do, you know, something very interesting to disrupt this industry, right? And I think at that time I was like, hey, I was at the point I was already, you know, making a risk in my life by, you know, moving to a different continent already. You know what? I mean, I always, you know, wanted to, you know, start my own business. Let's give it a try, right? And that was also like at that time I was also doing my MBA, kind of like the time, you know, I was kind of like exploring different optionalities. And I gave my time I gave myself pretty much a deadline. I was like, hey, I'm going to give myself like a year. If it didn't work out, then it's okay. I then go back to the workforce, right? But I think everything just really, you know, long story short, I mean, once I started this, I realized, hey, that's what I was good at. And that's where my passion is, you know, although there's a lot of challenges, but I don't know, I truly enjoyed it. And then in a blink, it just got to, you know, where we are today.
How would you describe, if you can remember, what it was like? Were you experiencing, I mean, this idea of moving to another continent, starting something new? Again, I talked about moving from a desk job to being an entrepreneur. What were some of the things maybe that you can recall? Do you recall being fearful, being excited? What was going on at that time?
Well, I mean, definitely there's a lot of uncertainties, right? There's a lot of uncertainties and you're pushing, you know, something new that, you know, even your customer or my then girlfriend or my parents wouldn't understand, right? I mean, that's what we call a disruptive idea. But at that point, you know, you just really got to have that perseverance and, you know, you can also call it stubbornness to move it forward, right? Also, you got to listen to the market. So, you know, it's a mix of things, right? But I think in the end, I'm like the type of person where I would rather be excited in an uncertain environment than bored in a, you know, very predictable environment. Felt like, you know, roller coaster sometime, but I enjoyed it. That's how I can put it in a summary.
What would you tell other budding entrepreneurs, people who are thinking about maybe doing something, maybe taking the risk? What advice would you give them? Because a lot of people are thinking, you know, again, like you're trying to weigh yourself, you know, do I do this? It's risky. You know, what advice would you give other people who have a dream and are on the fence about whether or not to pursue it?
Well, I think in the end, when you have a dream, when there's something you want to do, I always tell people, you know, go do it, right? Because in the end, it's better you have regret that you make the mistake than, you know, you regret not doing. I think that's number one. You got to ask yourself whether you are willing to put yourself in the positions, right? And number two is that if you're willing to put yourself in the positions, then make sure you're making educated and emotional guests, right? I think one of the biggest challenges for being an entrepreneur is that you got to be passionate, but at the same time, you have to be, you know, you cannot let emotion, you know, make all the decisions, right? I mean, when you are, you know, your passion in a product, when you push out to the market, you got to do MVP, you got to test all the response, right? You got to know when not to hold on too long, right? And there will be time that, you know, you'll be lost, you'll be frustrated. Then you remind yourself with, you know, what got you started in the very beginning, right? I think it's a lot of self-reflections and self-improvement. I think there's yeah, I wish I can summarize it in in just 5 minutes, but I think as long as you are making that choice willingly, knowing what yourself get into, and you have the right determinations, then you will enjoy the journey.
Nicholas, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say to anyone who's considering the entrepreneurial journey to have a go. You know, there's some massive highs and lows associated with it. And, you know, I had my fair share of lows. I remember in 1997, we had the Asian financial crisis. I was heavily exposed to US dollar debt in my company. And I was earning rupiah and Vietnamese dong. And, you know, we suffered enormous losses as a result of exchange rate differences that came about from the 97 Asian financial crisis. And we clawed our way out of that over 3 years. And I remember in 2000, you know, having got through that and dealt with our banking issues and other challenges, you know, I came out of that as a better person, as a better businessman, and having learned so much. And it's like all those sort of journeys through adversity, you come out a better person and a stronger person. And any entrepreneur who's considering that journey will pass through that, but it makes you a better person and it's definitely worth it.
Well, but thank you both for sharing that. I'm glad that you both agree. And I think we all agree it's a personal growth experience, which is really where the most value is. So I'm glad to see that we're all on the same page with that. Now, let's move forward here and talk about velocity. So you're in the ready mix business, which is concrete. Now, how did you end up? What happened after? I mean, it was many years, right? So why don't you tell us what it was that sparked your interest in starting Velocity?
Yeah. So I had an exit from our ready mix concrete business 6 years ago, Keith. We sold that business. And after taking a bit of time off, I decided that I wanted to come back and start a second career supporting other entrepreneurs on their journey and helping them not only to run their businesses, but with some capital. And so I started a small sort of private fund called Ready Ventures, which was the follow-on from Ready Mix. And we invested in about 15 different early stage businesses. And that was really an angel investing exercise where I learned the ropes of venture capital investing. And during that process, I came across a company called Edem, I-D-E-M, which was a software platform helping hotels manage group bookings. And I called an old friend of mine, Patrick Imbardelli. And Patrick was the ex-CEO of Intercontinental Hotels in Southeast Asia. And I said to Patrick, hey, I've seen this deal. Can you please have a look at it? I think it's interesting. So Patrick took a look and we ended up investing together in that company. We joined the board. We helped the guys at Edem grow and develop their business, and we eventually exited. And we exited that investment just prior to COVID, and that left us with the proceeds from that exit. It left us with an interesting partnership that Patrick and I had, me as an entrepreneur and him as a travel and hospitality veteran, if you like. And it was really that partnership and the proceeds of that exit that led us to create Velocity, which is a venture capital firm targeting travel and hospitality businesses that are transforming as a result of COVID. And subsequent to that was how we met Hans and the team at iGens.
So Hans, do you remember when you first met with Nicholas?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was about a year ago, actually.
And why don't you tell us how the two of you met?
It's interesting. It's actually through an introduction from our existing customers. I think at that time, we had a customer in the cloud kitchen concept, which is definitely a very hot space in, you know, during COVID now. I think it was through introductions from that client. And that's how we started talking. And I think at that time, you know, we were sort of, I mean, we actively look out for investors, as in, like, you know, we don't want to be in a position we really need investment, but we definitely keep an eye on, you know, good investors. And we, when we came across Velocity, we are very interested in how they, you know, really much specialize in hospitality and travel, which I found, you know, at that time, a lot of the investors are more like, you know, they are more like a generalist, right? Yeah, so I think through that discussions and we really enjoy, you know, the chemistry. A lot of time, you know, just from the meeting, you can tell, hey, what do the questions, like what they actually values, right? How much understanding they have on industries. And that, yeah, so yeah, everything just started from there.
So I want to make something clear for the listeners so that they understand. So Nicholas, you're in Singapore, correct?
That's right.
And Hans, you're in Hong Kong, correct?
That's right.
Okay. How did you meet? Did you meet virtually through introductions?
Yeah. I've never shaken Hans's hand.
Okay.
We're investors in his company. Yeah. So.
Right. So I guess the point is, you know, for entrepreneurs that are listening, that are looking to raise capital, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to meet in person and handshake, as it used to be the only way in the old days. So
you're absolutely right, Keith. But in fact, I've just written a blog, which is going to appear on our website next week regarding this exact point. And early stage investing is about backing individuals. And in order to do that, you need to understand, you know, who it is that you're backing and what makes them tick, what's driving them, get to know them. And, you know, the challenge of doing that through a screen is far greater than meeting in an office and then having a dinner and then going out for some drinks and having another dinner and getting to know each other. And I'm sure, you know, Hans will share his perspective on this, but it takes a lot longer to get to know someone through a screen than it does when you can head out and meet face to face. And I think, you know, that's a huge challenge for our industry at a time like this, is to get business done when you can't meet face to face.
That's true. However, the amount of time that you don't have traveling time, you can spend talking.
Yeah.
So, if you live in, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York,
yeah.
I mean, it's a significant amount of time. So
you're right. And I guess time will tell whether the sort of net of those pluses and minuses leads to efficiency. And I'm sure there's some aspects of business life that are made more efficient through a screen. But, you know, getting to know someone and building trust, in my view, is much harder over a screen than it is face to face.
What about you, Hans? Do you feel the same way? Because you're a different generation. So let's, from a younger perspective, what's your thought?
I think it depends on what types of meetings and what's the context, right? And also what is the depth of the conversations? So I definitely agree, you know, for first impressions, that definitely a lot easier, you know, to, you know, meet face to face, right? But I think, you know, in venture investing, I mean, we end up having to spend a lot of time, you know, in exchanges, sometimes even doing negotiations. And definitely face to face would be very different from, you know, meeting in person. But when you think about, like, even 200 years ago, right? Actually, a lot of people couldn't travel. It's actually through letters, right? So I would say that, you know, for a shorter period, you know, type of meeting, definitely face-to-face a lot better. But I think that's why, you know, we have rounds of, like, you know, negotiations. And I think that part, yeah, doing remotely is still feasible, right? And I think there's also little things we can do to make other side feel more comfortable. For example, I remember at one point when we were having a meeting, you know, with Nick and the team, I actually carry out a video cam walk around my office. I think just to help them to understand, hey, we actually exist, right?
I remember that.
Yeah, because I know that. I mean, you just can't be mindful, like, hey, there are certain things that the other side can see, right? It's about how I can tell the other side, how I can make the other side more comfortable. Yeah, I think Nick was also doing similar things, you know, to talk to our clients, you know. So that's some extra steps, but I think each of us understand what we need to do a little bit more extra from each of us to make each other understand.
Terrific. So let's talk now about agents. Why don't you tell us about agents, what it does, and so we can understand what problem it's solving.
Sure. So we are in the digital ordering space for restaurants, right? So when I say digital ordering, it covers anything that you place through a screen. It could be a mobile phone or kiosk or online website. I think right now, especially during COVID, the restaurants, they understand that by using technology is very important as how they can engage the customer and get more sales, right? In the past, restaurants, a lot of the sales are coming in from physical order, right? Where customer go inside the restaurants, place an order, do a cashier, right? But digital ordering mean that, yeah, now the customer place an order by themselves without a cashier, just on their screen. It could be a computer or a mobile phone. So through that, it's a lot easier for the merchants. They can streamline the entire operations, finalize the payment using digital payments, collect a lot of informations through big data. And for the restaurants, for the customer, you create a lot more convenience. So it's a win-win situation for everyone.
Now, Nicholas, when you first heard about the idea, what was it that you found interesting?
We're a COVID-themed fund, Keith, and so we're looking for themes that are accelerated by COVID, and contactless interaction between an F&B customer and an F&B outlet is clearly a theme that is accelerated by COVID. In addition to that, you know, Hans's product enables an F&B outlet to deal with multiple delivery platforms, multiple delivery aggregating platforms. And so we felt that, you know, what his product offers is for a QSR restaurant to be able to accelerate their business through COVID and beyond COVID, recognizing that a lot of these themes were already underway. And all that's happening is that they're just being advanced as a result of COVID ahead of time. So we liked all of that. And then we met the team. We met Hans and his partner, Peter, and we got to know them through that lengthy process that I described earlier. And we ended up doing a deal. So that was the story of our investment in agents.
So let's go back to something you mentioned earlier. You had said that it's not necessarily a fast process getting to know each other and obviously concluding business. So how long did it actually take from the time that you first met until you actually funded agents?
I think it was about 7 or 8 months.
Okay. Now, talk to us about, or how about Hans, why don't you tell us, as the founder of the startup, what was the due diligence process like? What were the things that you had to do to comply to meet Velocity's requirements? And was it anything, you know, like you had imagined it would be?
Yeah, well, I think due diligence is a process that, I mean, you can be done by a big four that can be extremely lengthy. It really, in the end, comes down to how much information that we let the other party understand, you know, so that they know what they are getting into, right? And then the foundation of it is definitely on trust, right? Yeah, so I think from that, we are a company no longer, we are not a startup. I mean, we started actually back in 2014, right? So we already had like years of operations where, you know, there are times things are a little bit messy, right? Then I think for us, a lot of the effort is really, you know, doing consolidations. But at the same time, you know, to provide, you know, the perfect due diligence, you know, at the level one, but Big Four, you take forever, right? There's also a lot of negotiation on the other side, you know, let Velocity to understand that, hey, there are certain things, you know, what a give and take, you know. So far, I think that so far that experience was constructive, I would say. It also showed that, you know, how each other, you know, we can compromise and negotiate. That's also very important, you know, for me as an experience. Right?
What type of information were you asked to share?
Well, I think it's in the end, it's really, I would say the standard information on financial or kind of like the company structure. I think for us, one of the challenges that we run in, we have a lot of different regional offices, and each of them were individually owned. And then for Velocity to come in, we also had to do a consolidations. But some of the consolidations require us normally flying in to country like Thailand, right? Because some of the paperwork actually requires you physically to be present there, right? So I think that that's also another challenge of like conducting business during COVID. So I would say, you know, that part itself is like, yeah, one of the examples. Yeah.
So I just so that, you know, a lot of people, it's their first time with a company and they're reaching out to get funding and they have no idea what the process is like, due diligence or what, you know, seeing what term sheets look like, things like that. Were you asked to share your technology? In other words, if they say, we want to have somebody look under the hood, somebody look at the back end, we want to know if we can really, if this is scalable. Did they ask you for information like that?
Yeah, actually, we did have a tech lead. So we did have sessions for, you know, someone who understands technology to look at our platform. I think that's a fair game, right? I mean, in the end, I mean, to be fair to the investor, I mean, they're investing their money in. I mean, it's fair to kind of look at what's inside. Right? And I guess a lot of the founders, they feel like the investor might kind of take away the secret sauce of their business. But I feel like if that business is so easy to duplicate, then that business itself has a problem already. Right? So yeah, we did have that process and we tried to be as open book as possible.
So Hans, tell us, who are your ideal strategic partners? If you could reach out to anybody, who would be, you know, ideal partners for you to come on board to work with you?
I think in the end, for restaurant tech, the space we're in, there are a lot of different players, right? You have the traditional point of sales that have been around for many years. Then you have the newer platform, like the Foodpanda or Grab or the payment platform. I think right now, everyone try to go into this space because they see that this space is growing and hot, right? But I think a lot of times there's a lot of overlap. So I think definitely, you know, I see that the partner would be the existing technology like the point of sales and also the other player like the payment. As well as the delivery partners. Yeah, I think those are, you know, kind of like the key pillars in the ecosystems.
So Nicholas, let's talk briefly about the fund. Now, you mentioned two companies. How many companies so far have you invested in?
We've invested in two. So we had the first close of our fund in April of this year. We've made two investments subsequent to that. Hans's investment and one other. And we've got two term sheets out at the moment and hoping to close another two within the next few weeks.
What would be helpful for you? Are you looking for more opportunities in your pipeline? Are you looking for more investment to come in? I imagine you still have quite a bit of money that you're looking to invest at this point, but what would be helpful to you?
Yeah, thank you, Keith. So I think two things. The first is, you know, we're a sector-specific fund in Southeast Asia. So we're looking for travel and hospitality startups in Southeast Asia that are looking for funding, that are innovative, that are looking to reinvent space post-COVID. So we'd love to meet anyone, any founders who need funding in that space. Our fund itself is a $20 million fund, and we're roughly 60% subscribed at this point. So we've got another 40% to go. We want to close the fund by the end of this year. And so if there are investors who are looking for exposure to the space where we operate, and the kind of investor that has got interested in our fund is are typically people who know the industry, who know the travel space or the F&B space or the hospitality space, and they want to have some exposure knowing that space and recognizing that there's an interesting recovery story ahead of us post-COVID, then, you know, we'd love to talk to them and share some ideas about what we're doing.
Now, what is your typical initial investment, and are you open to doing add-on investments?
Yeah, so our investment mandate is a check from anywhere from $250,000 US to $2.5 million US per company. And we are open to follow-ons. We're very open to that. So we typically wouldn't invest the full amount in the first round. We'd invest $1 or $1.5 million in the first round, and then participate in follow-on rounds when those occur.
Now, do you have a specific exit in mind when you invest? Are you looking to get out at a certain point, or are you waiting for, you know, an acquisition, or are you looking to get out at Series B? What's your exit strategy, generally?
Yeah. No, great question. And, you know, that's the chestnut of the venture model is how do you exit these positions. Our fund life is a 6+2 year fund life. And, you know, we see that as a result of COVID, there'll be a very quick turnaround in our industry over the next 2 or 3 years. And we think that the industry will rapidly move into an M&A mode a couple of years out from now. And so we see that, you know, there'll be some interesting opportunities to exit our positions 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now. And one of the things we've done to try and facilitate that is we've implemented a corporate partners program at our fund, where we share some of the innovation insights that we see as a result of seeing, you know, upwards of 400 companies a year. And we put together reports every quarter on all of the companies we see, and we share them with the big corporates that are in our space as a way of developing that relationship with them and kind of paying forward on the exit process. So it's really those companies that we see ourselves exiting our positions to, Keith.
Terrific. Hans, why don't you tell us how people may get in touch with you if they're interested in potentially investing down the road or becoming a partner with you? How can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I mean, my LinkedIn is super active. Just search my name on LinkedIn, give me a PM, or just WhatsApp me, right? So yeah, very many ways, multi-channel way to reach me.
So it's Hans Paul, HANSPAUL, on LinkedIn, and you're the founder of Agents, AIGENS. And how about you, Nicholas?
Yeah, thanks, Keith. So I'm Nick at velocityventures.vc and Nick Cox on LinkedIn, and very happy to connect with founders, with investors, or anyone in the travel and hospitality community and share thoughts and ideas.
Terrific. Well, thank you both for coming on and sharing your story. And I think there's a lot of exciting things happening in your space. And I think we're going to see a lot of great things happening. And I think Hans is going to see quite a bit of acceleration in these short months to come. So it's a great story. And it's a great service that you're providing, Nicholas, to companies that are looking to scale and make a difference. So thank you both again for the interview. And we look forward to hearing great things about both Velocity and Agents.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Funding and Disrupting. Don't forget to visit our sponsor, AuraCo.com, to learn more about working directly with Aura Collective's exclusive technology PR team. They'll help you craft your message, get noticed in the press, and help you get your venture to the funding finish line. Again, you can visit them at www.auraco.com. Keep funding and keep disrupting.